Hey there. Welcome to Spectrum West, everybody. Thanks for being here. And no, I don't mind in the least if you put one ear on Spectrum West and the other on the Brewer game. Or both ears on Spectrum West and both eyes on the Brewer game. I might be doing the same during our breaks here. I'll report what I hear along the way, and what I hear is that the Brewers are already down 1-0. Wow. Well, today on Spectrum West, we have theater in St. Croix Falls and an original play in Chippewa Falls. So lots of Falls theater. That means the one in Chippewa Falls, it's playing there, and the play takes place there, you see. We have designing clothes and things, and we have a pottery tour this weekend. Spectrum West is all about the people and places, the arts, music, and humanities we enjoy in Western Wisconsin. Please keep in touch on Facebook. Feel free to email us anytime with a thought or a suggestion for a guest or a topic. We're always looking for unique things to talk about. Go to spectrumwest@wpr.org. All righty, well, we're on the edge of the pool, and we're ready to dive in. It's the weekend of the 8th Annual Western Wisconsin Pottery Tour. And I spent some buzz time with Willem Gebben. He's a potter himself and the guy with all we need to know. Well, give us a bit of your background. How long have you been a potter, and where did you get your training, and et cetera?
I've been making pots for about 34 years, and I went to college in Grand Valley State College in Michigan, and then I was an apprentice to a potter in England. And I think I learned a lot more, you know, working in a working pottery than I did in school. And I've been making pots ever since then.
Are you a Wisconsin native?
No, I was actually born in the Netherlands, and my family moved to Holland, Michigan, where I went to high school. And then after I came back from my apprenticeship in England, I knew some people who had an interest in moving to Wisconsin because of there's a movement or a group of potters in this part of the country that are linked to English potter Bernard Leach and his student Warren McKenzie that had a lot to do with this idea of making useful pots by hand, having people use them in pre-industrial pottery.
Did you say Holland, Michigan?
Yeah, Holland, Michigan.
Why, did you go there for the tulips because you missed them? And
no, that's a whole other story.
It's kind of an interesting factor that you came from the Netherlands and went to Holland, Michigan.
I always say a very different Holland.
Yeah. Are there any windmills in Holland?
There is actually a windmill. There's a windmill that they moved there to a park in Holland, Michigan. Still there, and it's a part of the Tulip Time Festival, and called the Swan.
Well, how early on, as a young guy, did you think that maybe being an artist would be kind of neat?
Well, I've had my grandfather was an architect, and I have some uncles that are architects, and I always had an interest in art, and that's I went to the university thinking I was going to be a painter, but I took a pottery class, and I really fell in love with that, and I felt like I could be a better potter than I could be a painter.
Well, a fact is that art tours can get lost in the shuffle, particularly in this part of the state. So make a case for why this pottery tour should be on people's things-to-do list. Now, I noticed, for one thing, you have condensed the amount of necessary stops, and that might be appealing to some people. So give us a little thumbnail of how you've worked to design this to be appealing to people.
Well, we did it at this time of year because of, obviously, the colors, and it's a beautiful part of the state, and it's a pleasant drive in rural parts of western Wisconsin, and it's close to the Twin Cities area and to Eau Claire and Menominee and other parts. And then we thought if we could make it so there are fewer stops with more people at each stop, like there's 14 potters at four stops, that would cut down some on the driving and still give people the opportunity to visit studios and see how the pots are made and see the kilns and talk to various potters about their process. And then there's a good variety of work also.
We are talking with Willem Gebben. He's a potter, and our subject on this particular chat is the 8th Annual Western Wisconsin Pottery Tour. It may be that title a bit of a misnomer, because I read the tour starts just over the Minnesota border.
It's in the River Falls and rural River Falls area. So it goes out toward Randy Johnson stop, which is out toward Highway 63, but mostly in the rural River Falls area. there are some guests that are from Minnesota, but the majority of the people are from Wisconsin, and one of the guests actually comes from Louisiana, so Andy Shaw is from Louisiana, and the rest of the people, most of them are from Wisconsin.
How has the tour changed? I mean, this is the eighth year. What have you learned? Has it grown a lot since the beginning?
Yeah, every year I think word of mouth is a really good tool, and now there's a website, which I think is helpful to people to get directions and to see the work of the people who are involved in the tour. And, you know, this whole internet electronic age has sort of been helpful in that. So it's grown by people being on the tour and enjoying it and having a good time. And there's, you know, great food, and it's always a fun event.
Yeah, it sounds as if each stop, because there are multiple potters and artists at each location, will be busy.
Yeah, yeah. Parking isn't a problem, and everyone's really set up to handle the number of people that come, and we try to make it as pleasant as possible for the people that come to the tour so they have an enjoyable experience.
And you said that there are some amenities, like food and things
like
that?
Yeah, there's, you know, refreshments and usually lots of interesting snacks and things to drink, and that's appealing, too.
Yeah, that sounds good to me. You know, pottery is one of those art forms where the artist makes something that can be utilitarian. I mean, it can be a utensil. And that is kind of opposed to other art forms. Does a potter produce his or her craft with that utilitarian facet in mind? Or is it art first, pot or vase second?
I don't really see the division. I think that's sort of a... I personally make pots with the intention of use, and so do a lot of the other people on the tour, but I don't think we see it as a separation of having to choose between one or the other. I think they're sort of a combination of the art and the idea that that people can have art incorporated into their daily life through useful objects. I think that's what we're interested in.
Does the fact that it's going to be used, though, are there variables in how it's made and how it's painted, or is everything sort of made the same to be durable?
The majority of the people on the tour make stoneware, which is the most durable of the clay products, whether it's, you know, made industrial stoneware or handmade stoneware. Really, the materials are the same, but it's the process that's different. Yeah, when we make pots, I think we have that in mind, you know, how they perform and all that is important.
Well, of course, this is a tour, but it's also a sale. So lots of things, if not everything, will be for sale. The thing that I find most appealing about these tours is that one who partakes of it has the ability to purchase, particularly at this time of year, gifts for people that are one of a kind.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting part of the tour, and the whole idea of handmade objects is that they are unique, and that it's not, you know, it's not a mass-produced object, so it's not like everyone's going to have one. And even within the framework of a certain person's work, there's a lot of diversity, and, you know, they're not, like, making things in mass quantities. And then the process, the handmade process, always affords variability, and so it's not as uniform as an industrial product.
Why don't you be the guy who gives us the information? I know you mentioned a website. Let's give them that address. There's a tour map there, et cetera.
Yeah, the address for the website is westernwisconsinpotterytour.com, and that's all one word. That, I think, also has maps, and it has pictures of the work that's going to be there and some other information.
And that's tomorrow and Sunday. How early in the morning can people show up?
On Saturday, it's from 10 a.m. till 5 p.m., and then on Sunday, it's from noon to 5.
But as anyone knows who have done these tours, I mean, people aren't going to walk around at 5 p.m. and say, hey, we're closing.
No, that's right. We're, you know, we're there until we're done.
Yeah.
So if there's people that come, you know, at 4 to 5, we're not going to chase anybody out of there at 5 o'clock. There's, like I say, it's friendly and casual, and people generally have a really good time.
Yeah, and I wager that you could be one of those fortunate people. Thanks to Willem Gebben for taking the time to fill us in. And again, the website is westernwisconsinpotterytour.com. 16 minutes after 5, and this is Spectrum West. Well, time to find out what's happening in the world of theatrical enterprise with our very own James Oliver.
Here's what's on stage this weekend and beyond at Western Wisconsin theater venues. The Chippewa Valley Theater Guild production of South Pacific runs tonight and Saturday and Sunday afternoon at the State Theater in Eau Claire. The Menominee Theater Guild production of A Streetcar Named Desire plays tonight and Saturday at the Mabel Tainter Theater in Menominee. The original play Character Development plays tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Heide Center for the Arts in Chippewa Falls. See How They Run plays tonight and Sunday afternoon at the Northern Star Theater in Rice Lake. The Mystery of Norma Vep runs tonight, Saturday, and Sunday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The play will run through October 30th. Unnecessary Farce plays tonight and Saturday at the Fanny Hill Dinner Theater in Eau Claire. The show runs through October 30th. And in Hudson, Boeing Boeing continues tonight and Saturday at the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater. The show runs through October 29th. And that's some of what's happening in the region on Wisconsin Public Radio.
And Mr. Oliver will be back a bit later with a look at the unique production currently running at the festival that he alluded to in St. Croix Falls, The Mystery of Irma Vep.
Support for WPR comes from the Chippewa Valley Symphony Orchestra. Cuban pianist Nachito Herrera joins the symphony for its Music Without Borders concert, October 15th at the State Theater. Tickets available at cvsymphony.org.
Well, hey, you know, I've been on the receiving end of numerous news releases over my tenure at this helm of the ship about the apparel design and development program at UW Stout, always believing the art and creativity that goes into the process is good fodder for all of us to chew on here in Spectrum Westland. And I discovered a Stout mentor who agrees with that assessment. Her name is Catherine Kujawa. She's an assistant professor in Menominee. After getting a Stout release about Stout students winning national awards with designs appearing on some handbags and another that told of the work of three students appearing in the book Emerging Fashion Designers 2, I knew I had to talk to someone, and you were kind enough to consent. So thanks very much for being a part of this.
Well, thank you for talking about our program. We're always looking for more exposure in our area, but also anywhere. So we're always hoping that more people will find out about us.
Yeah, and do you agree about the artistic side of it?
Yes, we are artistic, but we certainly are different from a lot of other programs. But isn't there an art to living? Isn't there an art to functional clothing and having great products in your lifestyle? So, yeah, I believe there's an artistic part of it.
Well, part of your career, and we need to introduce you to people, includes a healthy stint in New York City, I saw,
yes,
where one can find just a little fashion and apparel design. So let's get to know you a little bit. Tell me about your career thus far as a teacher and person who actually does what you're teaching students to do.
Sure. I certainly didn't plan to be a teacher, but it's something that after 18 years as a sweater designer in New York City, you know, you kind of go through life changes. The market was changing. Certainly after the stock market crash of 87, there was less and less jobs. Companies were folding their domestic production, so a lot of things were going offshore, and I really liked to work domestically, and I like to boost the working man. So for me, that was a big part of it. But there also just was less creativity at that particular time, and I was basically hitting burnout load, too, after doing about 400 to 500 new designs every season. As a freelancer for many companies, it was just overload. So when you talk about artistic elements, at some point you need to replenish your soul, and that's kind of what I was looking for. And I had gone for my master's degree at FIT in historic costume and curatorial studies, and had hoped to maybe move into the museum world, exhibition design, things like that, which didn't really happen, but I did work on the Calvin Klein Archives project. I was the supervisor and creator of that, which put his 30 years as a designer onto a digital database system for both his internal use, but also we're hoping one day it will be opened up for everyone else to see. So that was an amazing use of kind of my life as a designer and the organization it takes to do that, and then also my history information and learning how to put together a mini museum.
Huh?
And then at that point, digital archives, a lot of people were still raising money for that. I was hoping that was going to be my future, but there just really wasn't anybody with a couple million dollars in their pocket. So I started to look for alternatives, and knowing that I love to be creative and I love change, I love to always be involved in that part of the design life. And teaching kind of came to me, and it's turned out to be a great outlet for me as well as them. We have students now across the country, and I feel like I'm a big part of what they've accomplished in the sense of understanding that this is a real job and it's really stressful, but you get to be creative and you get to be an artist. But you don't have to do it in your basement and struggle. You can actually get a really good salary and have a really great career and travel the world with it, as I did.
When you brought up sweater designer, that's a whole, man, that's a program in itself. I didn't realize there were just people who design sweaters.
Yes, we're called nitwits. We like to call it because we are kind of super techno geeks, because a sweater comes from ball yarn, and you basically have to make every decision. So it's not fabric that's already been created. Mm-hmm. It's a ball yarn, and you can do whatever you want with it. So we have a lot of our students in that because it really does speak to that kind of technological edge that many of our students already bring with them.
About the program now, UW Stout really does have some unique programs in which students can develop engineering graphics. I read one release earlier this year about some Stout students being named to the College Fishing All-America team.
Stout is a unique place.
Wow.
We are the only polytechnic university in the Wisconsin system, and we do get this really wide, broad understanding of students that come to us from maybe a small farm community, and they come here and they end up, you know, traveling the world in engineering or in fashion or really in so many of our areas that we have that are so different from a regular, university that basically turn out lots of gen ed majors. But here we have people that have that quirky mix, that person that wants a little bit of journalism or graphic design mixed with IT or mixed with engineering. So mm-hmm. We really have a unique student body, I think, as well.
Yeah. Speaking of IT, after 20 years in New York and now 12 years at Stout, from what I read,
yes.
You have then seen technology play a big changing role in what it is you do.
Absolutely. I was one of the first people to start working with computer systems for sweater design way back in the 80s when, you know, it was something very new and it allowed me to work faster, but not initially. It was a very long learning curve. And we find our students have the same thing. There's so much expected of them. They might have had many art courses, painting, drawing in high school. And now we're saying, okay, well, we want you to be as creative, but now do it all on computer because nobody's got time to sit and wait for the paint to dry. So, you know, it's a very very fast-paced industry that really you have to bring so many skills into the mix, not only sewing and pattern making and fit and possibly embroidery and, you know, knitting. It's now you also have to be as skilled with your hands with a pencil on paper as you are with a stylist or possibly pushing arrows on a computer system. So mm-hmm. Our students, definitely some of them struggle, but some of them are freed up creatively because of the technology. So it's a kind of a mix that is here forever. It's never going to go away. And it really is necessary because you need to kind of take out that nebulous area that some sketches have versus a computer where you're sending it to China and they need to see it all in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just become something that's part of our industry, and it does blend that artistic development aspect, but definitely with technology.
We're talking here on Spectrum West today with Catherine Kujawa, Assistant Professor of Apparel Design and Development at UW Stout in Menominee. How often do manufacturers and others involved in the apparel business, which, given our penchant for how we look and keeping ahead of the Joneses closet next door, is booming, how often do they look to fresh new faces in the industry, like emerging college students?
That's what they want. All of them want the young talent. Most of my friends, we consider ourselves design dinosaurs, and they definitely put us out to pasture. There's no doubt about that. Because it is that new perspective, hoping that, you know, they're in that pulse of the new consumer that's coming up. So the new grads that we have, many of them have very quickly moved up from interns into immediate assistant positions once they graduate, and now many of them are full designers already, many at Kohl's, Target, Christopher & Banks, Lands' End, then, of course, lots of places in New York and California. And the industry really looks to the young, so it is for the young, I have to say.
Mm.
It is kind of a time-lapsed kind of career that eventually you move up into management areas after a while. But it is because it is so much of the moment. It's about trying to be on trend, to predict those trends ahead of the game so that you're not out with every other competitor having the garment that you were supposed to have. So it is about fine-tuning your staff to have all those different opinions, the well-seasoned, you know, veteran who has many years of experience, but then you need those young people who aren't clouded by some of those problems from the past and can come and just give you, this is what I would wear, or this is what my friends would all want. So it's definitely a career for the young, for sure.
Is it tough to break into the field?
It's extremely competitive. It's more so than when I was there. In the 80s, you could quit on an afternoon and start the next day at a new job, and you could keep doing that. There were so many positions because there were so many manufacturers that were here. But because of basically the 90s wiping out American manufacturers, American companies that had been around for, you know, 50 to 100 years, mm-hmm. Now a lot of these big conglomerates have eaten up all these small companies. So now they don't need 7 designers, they need 2, you know, and they don't need several assistants because basically they have 30 people in China or Hong Kong or Taiwan who are fulfilling that role. So we basically tell our students it is extremely competitive, and that's why their portfolios and their skills have to be at such a top level to really compete, besides the fact that there are so many fashion programs throughout our country. And we're also, because here in America we allow people from other countries to come and take our jobs, it's a very different situation. So we also get all the people from Europe and all of the European schools come here because the pay is better, and you know, it's a way for them to get positions too, which are very, very tough to get in certainly London. So it's extremely competitive, and it is really kind of somebody who has all the right skills. It's not just talent on the page. It's so much of the communication skills. It's the professionalism and also having lots of internships and having lots of prior experiences that allow our students to get those jobs sometimes in front of other people.
Well, it appears Blue Devils scholars are getting everything they need. Thanks to Catherine Kujawa for her insights. She's originally from Milwaukee, so coming back to Wisconsin after the Big Apple isn't such a professional surprise.
Support for WPR comes from Festival Foods, featuring the new Val Nutritional Scoring System, combining nutritional information into a single number from 1 to 100, with more nutrition at the high end of the scale. More is at festfoods.com.
Thank you very much, sir. Tomorrow night, it's God Bless America, the music of Irving Berlin, featuring Mark Herman on the Wurlitzer Theater Pipe Organ, 7:30, Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. Contact the Phipps at 386-2305, online at thephipps.org. This is the weekend of the 14th Annual Fresh Art Tour in the Lake Pepin, West Chippewa Valley area. Go to freshart.org for more tomorrow and Sunday. It's also the Red Wing Fall Festival of the Arts downtown, tomorrow 9 to 5 and Sunday from 10 to 4:30. We'll have more of what's coming up in the second half. Hang in there after the news. We'll talk theater, a Chippewa Falls original, and a wild ride at the festival in St. Croix Falls here on Spectrum West. Hey, welcome back to Spectrum West, everybody. Brewers won, Diamondbacks won. Ooh. Coming up, a play in Chippewa Falls that takes place fictitiously in Chippewa Falls. And Jim Oliver checks back in with a vibrant guest here to tell us about a roller coaster ride of a play at the Festival Theater. But first, you know, we've done something risky. We've cut our upcoming fall pledge drive in half. 12 days to just 6. That means you get more of your favorite programs and less pledge drive. But we still need to raise all the money it takes to pay for your WPR listening. Support this idea of less on fundraising. Give now at WPR.org and help make it work, won't you? Thanks. On the things to do list, The Haunting of Potter's Field with some original music by Brian Schellinger, affectionately known as B Squat Woody or Uncle Squatty, plays tonight, tomorrow night, and Sunday afternoon at the Masonic Temple Theater, and that's in Winona, Minnesota. Tomorrow it's the Brews and Blues event at the Foster Cheese House in Foster. That's 10 miles southeast of Eau Claire, featuring the music of Acoustahoo with Sue Orfield on sax, beer tasting, food, etc. Information at 715-597-66. Well, recently I read that someone had written a play that takes place in Chippewa Falls, a very involved and intriguing bit of fiction with a touch of sci-fi and fantasy. So, I asked that someone responsible for the play character development, Rosanna Beejan, to stop by for a one-on-one. Well, you won the 2010 New Playwright Contest, which was sanctioned by the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association. And knowing what you're doing now with the play we're talking about today, I need to ask you if that was something that you decided on, meaning getting into that contest, after hearing about it, or was it simply a culmination of something that you have always been and maybe had in the wings for a long time?
I guess I'd go back a couple years before this contest. I entered the Eau Claire Children's Theater Writing Contest, and I won one of their play competitions there. So having done that, I had an experience with a short presentation. And so then when I saw that the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association was holding a contest, I thought, well, I'll try again. And then this one turned into a full-length production. So It was kind of a progression going from a shorter play to a full-length play.
But your background says being a playwright makes sense. Tell us about your background.
I'm a retired English teacher from the Eau Claire schools. I taught at DeLong for 29 years, and I'm starting my fourth year of retirement. So storytelling and reading stories and poems and all kinds of literature, that's just been my life over my whole life, I guess, since I've always been in school, whether I've been a student or a teacher. So stories are my life, or what I've done with my life. So wanting to create some of my own stories is pretty natural, pretty normal.
It's interesting, not knowing anything about you before we met, when I saw that you had won the New Playwright Award, I figured some real young person was going to come walking in. But that's actually kind of neat that, you know, people are reinventing themselves all along. And that's being a playwright, doing this, was that always on your things to do list as a teacher? Or did you do that when you were teaching?
Well, over the years, I'm one of those people always scratching down ideas on papers or poems, or I write poems, some very bad poetry, but they're mine. And so over the years, I've always been a writer, but writing for myself and nothing for a play. Tried my hand at short stories, poetry, song lyrics, different kinds of things, just as a means of expressing myself.
Sure. Well, character development is a rather fantastic story, and that's using the word fantasy as the root word. We'll get to the plot of the play in a moment, but tell me about how you write. Where do your ideas come from? You've sort of touched on it, but this, I think, is such a story that it's interesting to find out where it came from.
I don't think it just comes from one place. I think it grows pieces at a time. And this story started, I think, it's a fantasy. And when you have a fantasy, you have to have some means to get the fantasy going so people can get involved in this fantasy world. So my premise was, over the past years, it just seems like with the advent of digital clocks, whenever you see the numbers 11:11 appear on the clock, which you have twice a day, but not you don't really see it that frequently. So I like the idea that 11:11 kind of catches our attention. And this year being the 11th year of the century, we will have November 11th of 2011. So I still write in a checkbook. So I know on that date I'll be writing 11:11:11. And then the time will also be 11:11. So I thought, you know, here's a chance to take numbers and our fascination with numbers and put it to work and make it work for me in terms of that's where the beginning of the fantasy world for my play begins, where all I call it the gates of time and reality open once a century on this magical date of 11:11:11. Then, because it's a fantasy, I can include characters from fiction, real life, whatever can come back and speak.
So now, have you already given us a thumbnail, or is there more to talk about as far as the story goes?
There are really two plots to the story.
Okay.
We have the basic story starts out that the high schools from Chippewa Falls, I use that because that's where it's showing in Heidi, two high schools come together to do a production of Macbeth. And because it's on that magical date that they're rehearsing, the 11:11:11, Hecate, who's in Macbeth, who's the three crones went against her wishes, can then appear at that site because Macbeth is being presented. But we also have another plot of two teenagers that have a young love story where they have the love interested in each other and flirting and that kind of thing. So there's two stories going on. One of the real life of high school students And then the fantasy life of these good and bad characters returning from fiction to justify their behaviors from the past.
Oh, okay.
And an example from that would be that one of the characters I have returning is Jacob Marley. I taught A Christmas Carol for so many years at the eighth grade level, and I always thought that Jacob Marley didn't get his chance to talk. All he does is get to return and warn Ebenezer Scrooge.
And moan a lot.
Moan a lot and warn him that, you know, unless he changes his ways, he too will roam for eternity.
Sure.
And I always thought Marley should have been at least given a little more chance to state his point of view. So from a retired English teacher's point of view, I guess I empathize with minor characters in stories, and it's just like I want some of those characters to get a chance to tell their story too.
Yeah. We are talking with Rosanna Beejan. She is a playwright, retired English teacher. She has written Character Development. It is opening tonight, plays again tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Heide Center in Chippewa Falls, also a Sunday afternoon performance. We'll give you information on how to get tickets. Now, you are also listed as the director, and I'm curious whether it is work for a writer to help produce a play. Writing a play is one thing, but putting the play on, helping direct it, is another. Is that like something you didn't sign up for, or is it a natural transition for you? Because writers aren't always the most organized people, and directors need to be, so how's that working out?
Well, actually, I guess I've learned that I am not a director. So about a month before the show, we were even having auditions or the beginning of it, I realized that it was really too much stress for me to think of also being the director besides the writer. I did know from past experience and reading what other playwrights go through that when you first perform a play or you first have the rehearsals, it takes a couple of weeks where the writer needs to really sit in on the rehearsals and see what parts need revision, and that sometimes you just have to go off and rewrite scenes, that kind of thing. So before the production, I realized that it would be too much for me to be a reviser plus also be the director. So actually I called a person I had acted in the play Lost in Yonkers the year before with the Chippewa Valley Theater Guild, and her name's Rhiannon Schaub. Just thought she's a smart, sensible person and she'd be a good director, and that's proven true. So I think, to be more accurate, Rhiannon Schaub is the director of the show, and I would be her assistant director because she's very good at directing. And I found out that I really don't have the skills or the talent that it takes to be a director. I like being precise or being accurate or trying to be as perfect as I can writing something, but I don't have those perfectionistic skills for being a director. And I mean, you have to be very detail-oriented to be a director, and I just don't seem to have those skills or traits.
I'm glad that I asked that because sometimes they don't mix.
Yeah.
So what's next for Rosanna Beejan? What are you working on? Anything we should know about?
I actually have two plays in the hopper. The one a year ago or two when I won that short competition at the Children's Theater, the title of that play was 10 More Minutes for Andy Warhol, and it was a short play which was actually more like a 20-minute play, but the title playing on Warhol's 15 minutes of fame. And over the past 2-3 years since that play, I have been visiting Pittsburgh and have actually talked to the Warhol family and have been getting involved and getting more information on his life background, and want to extend that play into a full-length play.
Wow, the benefits of retirement.
Yes, so that's been a lot of fun doing the research.
How about his art? Do you have any of his art?
Not originals.
Not originals.
I have
but,
prints,
yeah,
yes.
Sure.
And I have been to the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh, I don't know, 4 or 5 times, in contact with a nephew, a niece, other relatives of his.
Interesting sideline.
Yes.
Well, break a leg with the play.
Yes, thank
Congratulations.
You.
Congratulations. And people should know that you can get information on it at cvca.net. And I believe you could get tickets there. There's also a phone number. That is 726-9000.
That's right. You can get tickets right at the door.
Are you going to walk out and make an introduction as the author? Or?
We haven't crossed that bridge yet.
Well, guess what? The bridge is here. It opens tonight. You'll have to show up at the Heide Center to see if Rosie, as she likes being called, actually does make it to the stage. Either way, it sounds like fun. Time is 5:47.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Wisconsin Credit Union, offering Money Mission, an online simulation tool that teaches teens how to manage financial obligations. WisconsinCU.org.
More programming and less pitching. That's what you told us you wanted, and that's what we're delivering. Our Half the Time Pledge Drive starts in just 4 days. Don't wait. Give now at WPR.org. Let's see. This evening marks the opening of a display of special artwork by past exhibitors, local artists, at the Northern Lake Center for the Arts in Amory. It opens tonight at 7:30, and tomorrow evening it's a Scotland Journal. As director Lemoyne McLaughlin and wife Mary Ellen tell of their journey to Scotland this past summer. It's not like the neighbors' slideshow, folks, believe me. I wonder if they'll have popcorn. Maybe you can bring your own. It's tomorrow night, 7:30, and it is free. What else? Today, tonight, actually, until 9:30, and then tomorrow from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., it's the 25th annual fall show at Caradori Pottery in Eau Claire. Six artists are participating. You can meet them this evening, and that's on Ferry Street in Eau Claire. Lots of stuff going on in the Chippewa Valley and beyond. Time now, ladies and gentlemen, for our nomadic, searching via technological channels of electronic research and communication, our human theatrical detection device, known as Jim Oliver, to report on what he's found in and around Western Wisconsin.
Jennifer Ward has directed productions in New York and Chicago. She's been an assistant director in theaters in Russia and Italy, among other places. And this fall, she is directing The Mystery of Irma Vep, which opened Thursday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Jennifer Ward joins us to talk about The Mystery of Irma Vep.
Hi, Jim.
Glad to have you with us today.
Glad to be here.
Charles Ludlam, who wrote The Mystery of Irma Vep, is noted for being one of the contributors to the avant-garde style of off-Broadway theater and for his outrageous spoofs. So what's outrageous about The Mystery of Irma Vep?
It is definitely a crazy, wild ride. This play definitely has a lot of history to it, and Charles Ludlam was a wacky guy in the Lower East Side of Manhattan, you know, in the 70s and the early 80s. And he did a lot of work that was exciting and controversial at the time. But when you sit down and actually look at the stories that he wrote, he was first and foremost an actor. What he was first and foremost interested in was playing characters. And I think that some of the outrageousness actually came as a byproduct of his interest in very specific characters. He seemed to be drawn to particularly dramatic female roles, and he wanted to find a way to really play these roles, not in a campy way. He was profoundly and quite articulately not interested in drag. But he wanted to say, this is the actor that I am. This is the body that I have. This is the character that I'm interested in. How do I, in the way that an actor would approach any other role that he or she felt was distant from themselves in some way, how do I inhabit this role, make it my own, be true to it, and create something that is moving and engaging and exciting? The byproduct part of that is that it's always funny to see a man in a dress. It just is. What we have really tried to do, and I think what he did so well, he tragically died halfway through his career, but I think what he managed to do really well and what we've sort of made our litmus test as we've been engaging in this story is this really fine tightrope between silly, delightful, energetic comedy and really dead serious, touching, sad, sweet, loving stories about people. Real people who, like us, you know, eat and drink and breathe and engage with each other and want to be connected. And so there's this sort of tightrope walk. Each of his plays was really this balancing act. he seems to have actually a lot of ambivalence towards comedy. He talked about how he was not interested in wittiness. He was not interested in just funny lines or even bits, which is hilarious because his shows are chock full of bits. But what he wanted to do was follow the story with the characters and then at the last minute pull the rug out from under them. The comedy comes in turning that sharp corner, the surprise and momentum of that, not necessarily just in a clever line. Mm-hmm. Danette Olson, who's the artistic director here, when she first approached me with this script, she and I were talking through it, and she used the phrase roller coaster to describe it. And I think that was so apt, because it's really just a ride. You get drawn into these characters who are slightly larger than life, but I think we're still able to really engage with things that they want. They want to connect to people, and they want to connect with each other, and they want to be their true selves in the world. They want to be understood, and they want to be seen for who they are, just like all the rest of us do.
Why don't you tell us what the story is about?
Absolutely. The short version, in the aftermath of secret hidden violence and a tragedy no one will speak of, this sort of brooding Heathcliff-esque Lord Edgar takes a new wife, Lady Enid, and brings her home to his family estate in late Victorian England, his lonely, desolate family estate, which is called Mandacrest. Lady Enid is certainly struggling to make a place for herself in this new relationship and in the sort of odd family that the housekeeper and the groundskeeper, who have been in the family for generations, sort of characters, trying to find a place for herself in this very unfamiliar estate and the crazy little family that these people make together. Hidden jealousies are revealed. There are ridiculous surprises and violent secrets. And in the process, we see that all of these characters have been hiding behind these intricately constructed masks. And over the course of the story, those masks are sort of torn away. And some of the characters are really quite destroyed by it, but there remain at the end some characters who are able to see each other truly and honestly, and sort of move forward into the future. And it's really funny.
That's the important thing.
It really is. This play was, I believe, in the year 2007, the most produced play in professional regional theater in the country.
She is Jennifer Ward, director of The Mystery of Irma Vep, which is playing this weekend at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. Well, who are the actors? This must be a gigantic cast.
It's not. It is a cast of two.
Now, I read somewhere that there is a requirement that both actors who are cast must be of the same sex, is that right, or same
that
gender?
That is true, the same gender.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, his longtime creative and personal partner did ultimately make the stipulation that that it could be done with two women, but the preference is definitely that it be done with two men, which is how it was originally. Charles Ludlam and Everett Quinton originated these roles and played them for years. So we have two gentlemen, Daryl Johnston and Carl Lindbergh, both of whom have worked at Festival Theater in the past. They play 7.5 characters.
Wow.
Through 35 costume changes. There's a scene between two characters on stage, and one of the characters leaves the stage, and pretty much through another door, immediately afterwards, that actor walks on stage as another character in full costume. So it's a play about doors in that way, that people are always coming in and out. There's offstage conversations. The actors consistently play the same role. Daryl Johnston plays Lord Edgar. He also plays Jane Twisden, who is the housekeeper, and a couple of mystery characters who surprise us through the plot. And then Carl Lindbergh plays Lady Enid, and then he also plays Nicodemus Underwood, who is the groundskeeper of the estate.
Uh-huh. So with all the costume changes, is there an elaborate set to go with it?
There is. The Mandacrest itself is quite largely realized in great detail. It's really an impressive monolith of an estate on stage. And then through some really creative work on the part of the set designer, David Markson, we are able to make Mandacrest disappear as we journey to Egypt and the depths of an ancient Egyptian tomb for Act Two of the play, where we find mummies and ancient tombs, and it's, yeah, it's pretty crazy. And then we return to Mandacrest at the end, but it is an impressive scene change.
Well, we've been visiting with Jennifer Ward, who is director of The Mystery of Irma Vep. It's a satire by Charles Ludlam and is playing weekends. It opened Thursday at the Festival Theater in St. Croix Falls. The show runs through October the 29th. Jennifer Ward, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for calling us.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include Big River Magazine, a bi-monthly publication exploring the Mississippi River from the Twin Cities to the Quad Cities since 1993. Available on newsstands or at BigRiverMagazine.com.
Wow. Thank you very much. And thank you, Jim Oliver. Thanks to all our guests. See you next week, which, by the way, I believe will be a twin spin by Mr. Oliver. He's working on a couple segments for next weekend's program, or next week's, next Friday's, including the big 12th annual Chippewa Valley Book Festival beginning on the 18th. But for now, I see the old radio-dometer says we've gone about as far as we can on this particular tank of gas. Next week, in addition to Mr. Oliver's surprises... That sounds like a show in itself, doesn't it? We'll spend some time with the local luthier with the international reputation. Gordy Bischoff will be here, and we'll have the scoop on an upcoming Jeffrey Keezer sighting in his old neighborhood. Last time I heard, Brewers and Diamondbacks were still tied. I'm kind of nervous to go back. At the Janet Carson Gallery in the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center downtown, Bruce Warren and Little Plus Pottery featuring superb black and white photography and wood-fired ceramics. That's up through November 18th. The show in the Foster Gallery of the Haas Fine Arts Center at UW Eau Claire is called Domesticity. I peeked in while at the university last evening. Very interesting, with a real homey feel. You'll see what I mean. It's up through October 27th. I'm Al Ross. Have a nice weekend, everybody, and I'll see you again here next Friday.